Don't you? It's interesting because the first time I did Ignite, back in 2007, I was in a very small theatre that was in the expo hall, and I was trying to deliver on certificate services, and there was some, I can't say this because we're basically recording, but let's say, think of the most creative expletive you can come up with, and let's go with that. Anyway, this guy just wanted to give away some motorbike or something like that, and I'm sitting there, nervous as heck, first time I've ever presented in a big conference, and there was a guy, right, and he just wanted to shout about this motorbike. And I'm thinking, it's a technical conference, it's not a motorbike conference. So when I heard that, you know, you're just having flashbacks. It doesn't matter how many of these I've done since, you know, probably more than 100. Still have that moment where I think I just want to throttle the guy with the motorbike. Okay, we've got a small crowd, but the way I want to kind of do questions is I want to sort of leave them more to the end because there's a bit of conceptual stuff. So if you came to my containers session on Monday, I did do it fully Q&A style, and that was fine for that thing because it was a very conceptual topic. Here I'm going to get to most of the stuff that we need to understand conceptually, and then the idea is then if you've got questions that we can go with that. Some of them I'll be able to answer, some of them might be a little curly, and I can certainly point you towards the correct person to talk about this. So let's look at this. In this session, we're going to talk about the basics of Windows subsystem for Linux. Why on earth, Windows subsystem for Linux, how you actually deploy it, what to do in case of fire, that is, if you completely mess up your Windows subsystem for Linux environment, how do you basically go and reset it, how you can navigate the Windows file system, or you can go and view where the Linux file system is stored. We'll talk about basics of updating, userland editors, task management, shell tools, configuring X and compiz for Ubuntu, the Ubuntu desktop environment, and what's coming in the Creator update. Now, this being a Microsoft conference, this is very much focused towards an assumption that you are not particularly familiar with the Linux environment. Now, I'm guessing to an extent that that might be not what everybody in the room is thinking about. But what you will see is you'll see me do some stuff, a lot of stuff in Bash, which if you're just a Windows admin that's never played around in Bash, you're going to be, oh, that's cool. And if you're a Linux person who's been doing it for 20 years, you're just going, eh, noob. Okay, so I'm going to sort of preface this here. Because one of the things that's important, especially when you're talking at a conference like this, given the audience, is that you've really got to say, okay, I'm introducing you to something that you're not familiar with, rather than saying that the default assumption is that you're familiar with both sides of the street. And again, this is sort of like a demonstration of what the technology does. And it's very important to underline what's going on with the technology, that the technology is really evolving. This is something that's only been in the operating system recently, and they're very much taking that rapid iterative approach. That means that the functionality that exists, if you're on FastRing, the functionality is actually changing in terms of what's supported each time or every couple of times we're getting a new build. So we've got Anniversary Update when it came out, and we've got Creator Update coming out very soon, and Creator Update supports a whole lot of stuff that Anniversary Update didn't do. So we'll sort of talk about that. So the basics of Windows subsystem for Linux. It allows a Linux environment above the Windows Linux kernel to run. So there's no Linux kernel there. It just kind of makes it look like it pretends that there's a Linux kernel there. So what this feels like is it feels like standard. It can be Ubuntu, but it can be also SUSE or something else. And when you're interacting with it, for the most part, it just feels like you're sitting on a standard Bash prompt or whatever prompt you want to go to, but Bash is the default, and that you can run Ubuntu utilities. And this is not a special Microsoft distribution of Ubuntu. This is just the standard stuff you'd pull down with apt-get if you were running another x86 distribution of Ubuntu. So it's a standard Ubuntu environment by default. You can switch it with other distributions. So, for example, there was a post on Slashdot about a month ago where the guy who was one of the lead maintainers on SUSE said, well, they made the wrong decision. They went with Ubuntu. They should have really gone with us. But the nice thing is, because all of the bits and pieces are there, you can swap out whatever distribution you want. And eventually you're going to see much better support for that, because suddenly it's one of those really weird sort of ironic things. Because Microsoft's actually putting this subsystem into Windows 10, suddenly to a certain extent, they can make you Ubuntu like by far the widest distribution, because all it is now it's an option that you can turn on in Windows. And that's very different from asking someone to go out to the internet to download an ISO, to put it in a VM, or to set up dual booting. It's still evolving and it's still a beta feature, which means not everything works. So what Microsoft's trying to do is iterate it. And they're getting so much positive feedback that there is a lot of impetus to keep iterating it. I cannot reiterate. If you follow Rich Turner on Twitter, he retweets some of the stuff and you're seeing it in comment section. So let's get to the sort of the why. One of the things that's really been, there's sort of been a perfect storm in the last few months. We've had the release of the new MacBook Pro, which has really disappointed a bunch of hardcore developers, simply because they did things like take away the escape key and they went and put it on the touch bar. And they took away a lot of the ports. And one of the things that you'll know about, especially people who are very much, have been around open source a long time, is that they tend to like the clunky hardware to a certain extent. All of the ports, all of the options. It's not about, just don't give me beautiful, give me really, really functional. So I'm a huge ThinkPad fan. And you can see that it's interesting in the ThinkPad community. There's been a lot of disappointment as they've made it a bit more consumerist. And then there's about 8 months ago, Lenovo, I'm what's called a Lenovo Insider, and basically a group of us have been pushing the company saying, release a classic ThinkPad. Release a classic ThinkPad with modern hardware. Just give us the keyboard and everything like that. And they said, well, we're not really sure that there's a market for that. And they said, you know what we'll do? We'll put up a blog post on the Lenovo website. And if you get over 300 posts on that blog post, we'll take a serious look at doing a classic style ThinkPad. There was something like 2,000 or 3,000 responses to that post. There's a lot of people that like that sort of thing. So what I mean about this is that there's a perfect storm. Here's Apple. Now, one of the things is that there's a great story about the writers of Silicon Valley talking about, you know, the monoculture of software and the monoculture of hardware in Silicon Valley, that they were literally up on stage at TechCrunch and every computer in the audience was a MacBook Pro. Now, it's not because these people are natural Apple users, because a MacBook Pro has that ability to run all of those open source tools that those developers want to use. And Microsoft's finally understood this. Maybe there was an understanding of this within parts of the organization, but that there's an understanding that a lot of people that are building, especially new software, are starting off with an open source toolkit. That if I'm going to paraphrase, and this is my opinion, it's not Microsoft's opinion, Microsoft's developmental software is very much an industrial scale development software. That when you look at the people that are sort of weekend coders, the people that are playing around with experimental languages, all of these experimental languages, all of these sort of smaller development environments are available as open source. So for a while, Microsoft Press was published by O'Reilly. And O'Reilly, of course, has their open source con. And one of the things that was in Portland, my editor told me, he said it was amazing because you had this convention that was spread across all of these rooms, and you'd have this small room where there'd be like five people who were passionate about a language, but they were the only five people. But the only way that would work for them was that they could do it with open source. There was no one was going to go and build an IDE, no one was going to build a development environment on Windows if the audience was already on open source. So what providing all of this for Windows does is it makes Windows a platform that the people that want to play around with those languages and normally would have bought a Mac to go and do so, go, you know what, I can do this on Windows. And then suddenly by doing that, Microsoft as a platform in some way becomes more relevant to it. Now, it might be that these people never go and deploy a Windows server. They still end up running their workloads on Linux in the cloud in AWS, but they're at least being exposed to that. They're not sort of starting out with a MacBook and going, I'm never going to touch a Microsoft laptop, because suddenly they're in the ecosystem in some way. So that's part of it, but it's also that remaining relevant. There's a book called Code Monkeys. It's all about a guy who's a developer who ends up at Facebook, and he discusses the process of the way that they're doing development. And he says, oh, no, I had to have a Mac, because that was the easiest way to go and interact with the cloud, because we were running all of our computers, all of our servers on Linux, because it was the cheapest way of doing it. And if you've got that mentality, of course you need that open source toolkit, and it needs to be available on Windows in a way that makes sense, not some kludge which it's been in the past. So that's sort of why. And that's the argument for it. You go and do this, and you go and look at the Twitter feed of the Microsoft people that are responsible for this, and there's literally people saying, I'll go and buy a Surface Book now. I'll go and buy a Windows laptop now. Why? Because I can get my tools. And it's all about the tools. It hasn't been about what the laptop is. It's, do I have access to my tools? Yes. If I've got access to my tools, I don't care. So let's talk about requirements. You need the anniversary update or later, which is pretty much what everybody's running unless they deployed Windows 10 really early and they were on the long-term servicing branch in an enterprise environment. You go and enable developer mode. I'll show you how to do this. And then you enable the Windows Services for Linux feature. In terms of backing up Windows Services for Linux, at the moment, you can do it. It's just a bunch of folders in the file system. So when you go and turn it on, you turn it on at the operating system level, and then you basically run a command that says set up bash. And then what it'll do is it'll go and pull down all of the stuff it needs to go and pull down. And it'll go and put all of this environment on a per-user profile basis. So if you're the only one using the laptop, it does it once. If you have multiple people that use that computer, it will go and install a separate Linux environment for each person. So yes, that will consume more disk space. And then within each Linux environment, you can have a multi-user environment. I don't know that's necessarily the best way to do this, but that's the way that they are doing it, because when you go and set it up, you run it, and then you assign a root password, and that's your root password to your environment. And then if you go and log in as another user, and then you type bash, it'll go out, and it'll pull the bits down, and it'll give you bash in your app data directory of your profile. So that's how that works. In case of fire, okay, you can run the command lx run uninstall. Now, when you run it with uninstall, it'll leave everything that's sitting in your home directory. If you go lx run uninstall full, it'll take the whole thing off. And if you go lx run install, it'll go put the whole thing back on. So if you completely hose your environment, these are the commands that you run. And you decide whether or not you want to kill it. Now, again, remember that this is an experimental environment. So you make the decision as to how much of it you want to keep. But if you're supporting developers and a developer says, I just hosed my environment, I just went and did something and I need to reset, all you do is you run these commands and it'll go and reset their environment. And then you're back to where you need to get to be. Okay, so navigating the Windows file system, and I'll show you all of this in a demo. So for example here, you can go into the mount directory and then mount C, and that's volume C, and then for example Orin desktop will take me from bash into my desktop folder in the Windows operating system partition. I can go to mount E, which would be volume E. Now where Windows subsystem for Linux lives is C users, and then whatever your user account name is, appdata local LXSS, Linux subsystem. So everything under there is got all your Linux binaries, all of your data, that's where it's going to be kept. Now, remember that the slides and this session is going to be recorded, so it's okay if you want to go and take photos, that's cool, but it's all going to be online later and you can just download the MP4 and watch it that way. Or, you know, and the slides are available for download, or email me and I'll send you the slides. Okay, so updating. Again, this is going to be dead normal and dead obvious to you if you have been using Linux for any amount of time. And my own history, I started in 93 when I worked at the University of Melbourne in IT support, like Frisch did, does, still. I don't know if you were there when I was there. No, okay. So what happened was I started as a postgraduate and I started doing tech support. And one of the benefits of being in tech support was that they allowed me to have a 386, and I put Red Hat on it, Red Hat probably 4, and actually was running it as a web server. And it ultimately became the mirror of the Terry Pratchett fan site, elspace.org, which is I actually got my start on the internet by, my first email was to Terry Pratchett. My first email that I got from anybody was from Terry Pratchett. And I spent most of the 90s doing Terry Pratchett fan stuff on the internet, supporting his Usenet newsgroup. So I actually wrote the FAQ from 1994 through to about 2005. And this is how I actually started. I started and I learned how to set up a web server on Linux, so Apache, and then we had a CVS repository, and then we'd go and pull a copy of the main website. So we actually had mirrors in each country of the Terry Pratchett website, and I was the one who maintained the Australian mirror. So I started out as a Linux admin because it was just a sort of a hobbyist thing, because the university at that time was still on Banyan primarily. And then what happened was I got a full-time job in IT support because they wanted to pay me money for fixing computers because they didn't know how to do it in that particular area. And I worked under a guy who was such a Linux god that we bought a new server and it had a tape drive in it. And he looked around and he thought, oh, this hasn't got a drive for the tape drive. So, you know, cracked the knuckles and 6 hours later he'd written one. So one of the things I realised right then was that there was no way I was going to really progress up the ladder at that particular IT department because this guy's Linux skills were off the chart. And then someone came in and said, okay, well, the university is going to adopt Windows NT. We're going to be running courses for people. And they said to this Linux guy, do you want to go on the NT administration course? And he went, nah, that's a toy operating system. Send Oren. So Oren went off on that course and then became, you know, 40 bits later, one of Microsoft's authorities on Windows Server. And I'm writing the biggest book on Windows Server that's ever been written. But that's my story. But I started off as a Linux administrator. And then just simply because of where my career took me, I got into Microsoft. So obviously this is not how you do it on Red Hat. So apt-get update, and this is again for the recording, refresh your package availability, upgrade your currently installed package, auto-remove removes the application, any of its dependencies, apt-get clean goes up and cleans up your cache. So userland editors, you can apt-get install a utility, so you can do Vim, Pico or Emacs. I'm using Pico or Nano there, but I'm always been more in VI than Emacs because I just never got around to learning Emacs. VI was basically what we used at Computer Science when I was, that was before I went across. Task management. So you can do things such as running HTOP. And I'll show you that in the demo. So you've got PS3. And the whole idea of this is to show you that all of these things that you would use to manage processes in your Linux environment, if you were just running a shell on whatever, are going to work on Windows when you're running for Bash for Windows. And that's the cool thing about it, is that especially, and you'll see me do the demo later, you'll get to the point where you can use virtual desktops on Windows and you can literally just switch between X Windows and Windows, and you just switch and you've got both. So in the past, the only way you could do that on Windows was actually to spin up a virtual machine and have it in under one desktop and then you'd switch between them. Now you don't even need to do that. And the cool thing which I'll show you is that WSL has full access to the full hardware. So you can even see this a bit here. This is running on my P50 ThinkPad when I took this screenshot. Now my P50 ThinkPad, as you can see, has a nice 64 gig of RAM on it. And WSL has access to all that RAM. I'll show you a little later that it'll actually get the processor, which is a Xeon processor. So the weird thing is, if you actually go and run it in a VM, you sort of go off and say, oh, I'll give you so many gig of RAM to play with. Here it's saying, no, I've got access to whatever the operating system has access to. So it's not a virtual machine. It's almost, you'd think of it as a translation layer, that literally what would normally go down to the Linux kernel is being sort of going down to the Windows kernel. The instructions are coming down in Linux and then they're being translated to Windows and then being sent back up and then going back to Linux. And there's a whole lot of technical videos on how this works available on channel9.msdn.com if you're interested. So, for example, you've got tools like Tmux. Again, something that you'll be very familiar with if you're on the Linux side of things, something that if you're on the Windows side of things and your interaction with the console has primarily been PowerShell, you're probably sitting like, oh, this is interesting, and I'll go through and I'll talk through it. Because again, if you're showing this to Windows administrators who haven't been in that environment before or haven't spent time in the Linux shell environment, this is like, well, this is actually kind of cool. And the cool thing is that with the Creator update, which is coming out in the next few weeks, you can then call Windows binaries from Windows Subsystem, from Linux, so from Bash. So literally, you can use Tmux with PowerShell. So you can have your PowerShell windows and switch between PowerShell windows in the same way that you would switch between Bash. So just think about that in terms of your productivity as a Windows administrator, because suddenly you've got this much more powerful command line environment for doing PowerShell stuff, rather than just, you know, where you're limited to basically, you know, I need another window, so I go and instantiate another window. You've got Midnight Commander. That runs on Windows Subsystem for Linux. Okay, so what we just saw is that essentially you've got your Linux tools, and they're basically unmodified Linux ELF64 binaries running directly on the Windows Subsystem for Linux. It's a new feature of the Windows kernel, exposes a Linux-compatible syscall layer and process models, supports forks and many syscalls, and many more syscalls are being added over time. So what we'll do is we'll do the first of our demos. So what I have here is I've got a little virtual machine, and this is running, actually, the latest update, the latest version of the FastRing operating system. So if you want to go and turn this on, the first thing you do is you go in and you type developers, and it comes up with the developers control panel here. And then you just basically say, I want to turn on developer mode. So what it'll do is it'll go in then, and when you do that, it'll put it into a special mode where you can do extra things to the operating system. So the idea is at this point in time, this is not something you would deploy out to your entire fleet of Windows laptops. Why? Because obviously very few people in your organisation are going to need access to this. But you're going to have developers and they will need to know how to turn it on. At the moment, it's not supported through things like Configuration Manager. But eventually that'll be the thing. You'll be able to basically get an option in Intune or EMS or Configuration Manager where you say, yep, I want to go and have Linux lit up on this particular group of machines. And then you'd be able to manage it centrally, should you so choose. So once you've done that, the next thing you need to do is you go in to apps and features, which is what the new things that they call it, which I find a bit of it annoying because it means I just have to go over here to get the program features, Windows features on or off. And then you scroll down here, and then you've got Windows Subsystem for Linux. So you click that. You click OK. So what it does is it'll go and say, restart the computer. So now what I'm doing is I'm going to restart that VM. Now the reason I'm showing you, I've got everything else set up on the host machine, but I want to show you just sort of how you go around to setting this up. So anybody who watches my Pluralsight courses knows that I use Chancellor as basically my root account name. Okay, so we're back into the operating system. So to get this set up, what we do is we type bash. So let's make that a bit bigger. So the first thing it does is it says, okay, this is going to go and set this up. So yes to continue. So now what it does is it goes out to the Windows Store and it pulls down binaries. Now, I haven't signed into a Windows Store account. Windows Store is simply where the default installation starts from here. So it goes down and it pulls down this environment. So I've turned on Windows Subsystem for Linux on the operating system level, and I've logged in as Chancellor, and I've run Bash. Now, if I logged on as Kermit the Frog, and I ran Bash, it would then go out and grab this and pull this down, and Kermit would have a completely different Linux environment to me. Now, within this environment, I can create multiple users should I so want. But I'm trying to get you to understand sort of how it works in that you have partitioned Linux environments, assuming that, you know, we've got so many laptops and computers around these days that we really do are in a situation where we've got multiple people logging onto the same computers. But maybe in Frush's case, if you're looking after a lab or something like that, you're sitting there going, well, each student will have their own environment. Okay, yep. It would, I don't think so at the moment, but the way I'd get around that is I'd give them multiple accounts. So then it extracts a file system. Now, this is all sitting in a VM, so this is not really running as fast as it would on native. But again, I wanted to just give you an idea of the steps that you go. So who here has actually set this up already on their machines? So only a couple of you. Okay, so this is useful from the perspective of this is actually all you need to do to turn it on. So as long as you've got version 16.07 or later of Windows, you're fine. So we'll give that a sec. Anybody else got? Okay, so the next thing that this will do is it'll ask me basically for a root password for this account. It'll say what we want you to do. Okay, new Unix username. Now, this can be anything, and it is separate from whatever your local logon name is. So here I'm going to do the same thing. Actually, now what I'll do is I'll set it to Rodimus. For those of you who know your Transformers lore, Rodimus was the leader of the Autobots after Optimus. Come on. I mean, you guys are in a Linux for Windows session and you don't know your Transformers? Really? Okay, so to give you an idea of what this is doing. Now, this is a very recent build. This is like one that literally came out in the last week. So now, the previous version, and you'll see this when I go across to my main conference machine, is version 14. But if I do a LSB release minus A, what I'll see here is I'm actually on Xenial. So Ubuntu 16.04.1. So it's version 14 if you are on the standard version of Anniversary Update. And with Creator Update, every version that ships with it will be Xenial. So what have we got? Well, we can look at the file system, and we can see that we've got the file system there. If we want to see what the CPU info is, for example, this is in a VM, of course, so I do less proc CPU info. And that will see there that it's picking up that it's a Xeon processor, and we've got that information there. So it's got there. And then, of course, you can do things like sudo apt get install fortune. And I'll go and pull that down. And this is just, you know, showing you a few little silly bits and pieces when setting that up. So if I go and then run fortune, I get a fortune cookie. Now let's say install sudo apt get, oopsie-daisy, install cowsay and lolcat, because, you know, we're playing in that world now. And then that will go out and they'll grab that. So again, the idea I'm showing you here is that this works exactly as you would expect it to if you were running Ubuntu normally. It's going to, and you can see it's going out to archive.ubuntu.com. So this is not hosted by Microsoft. This is pulling this off the Ubuntu service. And one of the things that you can do is, of course, you can set up your own repo on your network, and then people can just be pulling it that way. So one of the things I've got actually set up at home is I'm just running a Linux VM, and then I've just gone and pointed it in exactly the same way that you would point a normal Linux distribution at another repo, and it just goes and pulls that across the network. I'm just doing it this way because I'm seeing it all up from this. So it's going in, it's modifying all of these, blah, 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 blah. And you can see it's pulling in all of these bits and pieces. But their ultimate aim is that anything that runs on Ubuntu will run on Windows. That's the aim of this project. They're not going to go, we're going to half-ass it and we'll be finished. They want to get to the point, and they're literally like, okay, go and I'll show you the links later, go and file bugs if you've got something that's important to you that doesn't work. So here we go, fortune, that's it, Ozzy. Fortune, pipe it to cowsay, pipe it to lolcat, and of course you know that then we get the nice colourful lolcat cow. So are these real Linux binaries? So if we do a file of bin bash, we can see there that it is an ELF 64-bit Linux executable, and that's obviously GNU Linux. This is not something that Microsoft's done. And if you wanted to, you can even go sudo apt install caca utils. Yes. That's nice and piercingly loud, isn't it? So again, one of the things that this thing is demonstrating here is it's showing that we have the ability to go and then do something like CACA fire, just showing you that, again, and this is running in a VM, that you have a lot of the console colours and functionality that's available in Linux is now available on Windows Subsystem for Linux. Okay, so we know that you can then do apt get update. Oops, sudo apt get sudo apt update, and it'll go and then update. So obviously you install, and it'll pull what it does pull down from the Windows Store, and then it's going to go out to the Ubuntu archives and actually pull that, and then upgrade, and it'll go and do that for me. So it's only going to pull 13 meg down of stuff, but obviously if you are going to deploy this in a production environment, you're wanting to make sure that your people are actually making sure that all of their Linux utilities are kept up to date, because, you know, those people are actually pushing updates for a reason. So, as I mentioned, we'll just wait for this to finish. Actually, that's going to take a while. So what I'll do is I'll jump back to the slides. Okay, so CompIF. You can run a full Windows manager using an X Windows client or an X server, basically, that you can download from SourceForge, and then you can run a full X environment on Windows Subsystem for Linux. So again, you're not running a VM and running everything. You're running Ubuntu, and then you're pushing stuff into Ubuntu from X Windows. It requires X Windows server that supports OpenGL if you want to use CompIF. So you can use some of the simpler ones with other more popular X Windows manager, but the advantages of the one that I'll show you is that it supports OpenGL. So you get all that compositing, you get the transparency, you get some of the 3D stuff as well. So I'm just trying to remember what the name of the normal one I used before I went across. Oh, look, I'll show you it in a minute. So you can actually get fairly, not just simple crappy X Windows, you can get really nice X Windows. So that's 58%. Okay. So preparing, you need VCX SRV. So VCX SRV is available up on SourceForge. What you do is you configure it when you set it up to use display number 0. And you can choose to go either full screen or one large window. So full screen is if you just want it to full screen. I will run it in one large window because I've found that when I'm shifting between desktops, sometimes on the current version, which is anniversary update, it gets a bit snarky and sometimes it disappears if I keep shifting desktops too much. Whereas if I go with full screen, with one large window, I don't have that problem. Now, there's a couple of bits and pieces that you need to do. You need to prepare dbus. So this is a bit of a hack where you basically, you run this command sudo sed, and then you pipe this through here. Again, this will be in the slides that a bit you'll be able to download. And then you prepare your display. You say export display localhost port 0.0. And you could set that as an environment variable where that happened all the time. Just wait for that to come through, and I'll finish. Okay, so actually, I'll tell you what, rather than waiting for that to do all of that, so that's just showing you apt-get and that how that works. Okay, so what we'll do, so, oopsie-daisy. So what I'll do, this is on my desktop here. Okay, so for example, you can use tmux. So where I like tmux is can go into a split and then split there. So for example, I can then run htop and I can have htop there. So as I pointed out, it's now got running 12 gig of the 64 gig available. That's primarily because I'm running that virtual machine. So there I can do vi test.txt. Now, found a swap file, blah, 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 blah. Do I want to do anything with that? Actually, what I'll do is I'll just go q vi orin.txt. So if I write this, oops, so I do this file, escape WQ. So if I then go C colon orin, whoops, it does the users orin d app data local lsx. So this is all of the Linux stuff. And if I go into my home directory and orin, I've got orin.txt there and orin wrote this file. So in the anniversary update, the change tracking is not as good as in the creator update. In the creator update, I can then modify on each side and it will work flawlessly. Here, sometimes it will work with a few problems. So again, creator update is going to be live in a couple of weeks, if not sooner. I think it's March it goes live because they've been talking about version 1703. I do not understand why Microsoft, which is full of geeks, did not release creator update as version 1701 and call it enterprise update. I mean, come on, guys, stutter it. But if you wander around the file system here, you can go in LSXS, and if you go down to rootfs, you can see here we've got bin, boot, cache, data, dev, etc. So if I go into bin, there's all of those utilities that are basically the standard binaries for Linux. So you can see all of that from within the file system, or for example here, if we go back to here and we go cd mnt, and then we go c, I'm in the root file system of Linux. So if I go then to orin cd users, whoops, it is cd users, because we're in bash, so where are we? So if I did vi test, and then went back, of course, here, and minimise that, and minimise that, I've got test.txt sitting on my desktop. So I went and did that in vi. Okay, so configuring compiz. This is important, and this you will want to pull the slides for. There's a whole lot of options. So once you install, you need to go and install the Ubuntu desktop, and you need to, so apt-get install Ubuntu desktop, apt-get install compiz settings manager. And before you run Ubuntu desktop, run CCSM, and that'll bring up this dialog here. And make sure that you go through enable commands, composite, copy to texture, OpenGL, Enhanced Desktop Zoom, Expo, Ubuntu Unity plugin, and then there's some more that you need to turn on. Animations, fading windows, PNG, library toolbox, mouse pointing, regex mapping, and then move window, place window, resize window, scale, snapping windows, Unity MT grab handles. Oops, daddy. So again, we can pull this up here. So of course here, you can go and create extra windows and then just shift between them. Who here's used tmux before? Okay, so what tmux is it's basically an environment that allows you to have the terminal. and utilize the terminal. And then you can have multiple windows within the terminal. So here I'm on basically window 2. If I go back to window 0, what it means is each one of these windows is functionally a separate terminal. So for example, if I wanted to know how to use one of these, what I can do is switch between them and make each window active. So here I'm here and I can go LS. And then if I wanted to go across to the previous one and then say go man tmux, I can pull up the manual page for tmux and then have that in this window here. So the idea is if you've got a terminal window open, you can be doing multiple things within the one terminal window. Now where this is cool from a Windows administrator perspective is think about using this with PowerShell. You've got multiple PowerShell sessions, and instead of switching through all of these things, you can literally have all of this happening in the console. So if you're managing a bunch of nano servers or server core where you've just got PowerShell sessions, instead of going in through the multiple sessions ability of PowerShell ISE, you can just run PowerShell as an executable from here, and then you're fine. There's also PowerShell for Linux. So you can install PowerShell for Linux and then use that to create remote connections to your Windows servers. So one of the other things that Microsoft's doing is they're trying to make many of their tools available across multiple platforms. They're trying to make PowerShell something that you might use to manage Linux systems, or it might simply be that you put PowerShell on there and use PowerShell on Linux to go and manage Windows systems. Or Azure. Or there's other bits and things like Amazon which you can manage via PowerShell. Okay, so to get out of these, you just type exit, quit that, exit, and that'll pull me back to there. So I quit that. Yes, I want to quit it. Exit. Okay, exit. So what we'll do is, here we are back in our slides. So running it, you run compiz. So that's fairly straightforward. So what I do is I will pull up my bash window again. But before I do that, I run xlaunch. I make sure I've got one large window. I set that to 0. Click next, click next, click next, click finish. Okay, so that's my X server. I type export display equals localhost. :0.0. Now, normally you'd put that in an environment variable, but that's something that you need to load each time you do this, and then you just do compiz. And so we switch back to our X server, and it brings up the Ubuntu environment. So, for example, I can now switch between Windows and Linux, Windows, Linux, Windows, Linux. So, of course, you can do everything that you normally want to do in Ubuntu here. So, for example, I've got a terminal there. I can run HTOP in that terminal. You can see there that it's showing that it's, again, got access to that 64 gig of RAM. I can fire up Firefox. So there's Firefox. And then if I do an about on Firefox, I will see that it is running on Ubuntu Linux. So that's that version of Firefox, and then if I come over here, I would have a version of Firefox. If I just hit escape, that version of Firefox here, and I do an about here, that's the Windows NT version of Firefox. So for those of you who are not familiar with virtual desktops on Windows 10, you've got this little button over here. You click that, and what you can do is you can go and create a new desktop, and you can come back to another desktop. Oops, it over come here. And then you can go, you know what? I want to take that window there and drop that onto my third desktop. So then I've got third desktop, second desktop, first desktop. So it's one of those things that a lot of people didn't realise has been put into Windows 10. But, again, you can go from there. Okay, so I'll bring that back up. So when you're in here, you can do all of these other cool things. So if you wanted to go and run LibreOffice, you can run LibreOffice. And then you've got LibreOffice running there. You can also do things such as, should you so choose, change the background. So for example, I could go here and change it to nice flowers. Now, one of the things that you see there is that you can see over here with this window here that transparency is working. So that's why you're using that particular window manager, because you get all of that compositing and so on in the Windows manager. So the thing that your people who will be used to using Ubuntu environments will see is that they're not being treated as second-class citizens. So all of those beautiful bits and pieces that they like about their Linux environment, they're still going to get to do. They're still going to get to put their backgrounds on. They're still going to have the transfer. And eventually, all of those things that are in the, you know, the, all of the animations and things like that are in some desktop environments will be supported on Windows. And that's important, because when you're trying to communicate to people, hey, look, you can use your, we'll give you a Windows machine and you can still do all of your Linux stuff. You can show them and you can have it look like this. It's not that we're giving you a dodgy Linux experience. We're aiming at giving you actually a comparable Linux experience. And that will go a long way to making certain people happy. Okay, so you can also, of course, do things like open up a new terminal and then do sudo synaptic. Oops. Which will give me Synaptic Package Manager. So obviously then, when I'm wanting to do things, I can then go down in Package Manager, I can go to Editors, and I can say, right, I want to go and install Vim GNOME. So I just go and select that package, mark for installation, apply. And again, all I'm showing you is stuff that's, you know, bog standard, boring, and easy to do on Linux. But what I'm showing you is this is all running on Windows. So suddenly, every bit of those tools that you had on Linux is now available on Windows without deploying a VM, without worrying about a VM. So that's all done there. Let's verify that. So again, if I go new terminal, run gvim, there's gvim. So you can go and install anything. I mean, not absolutely everything's going to work, but a lot of it's going to work. And the aim is that anything that will work normally on a stock standard installation of Ubuntu is going to go and work on Windows Subsystem for Linux. So it's not that you are getting a, you know, this is as far as, I mean, again, I'm not living in Ubuntu every moment, but this is pretty much most of what I would do in that Linux environment when I'm running a VM running Linux. This is the sort of stuff I'm doing. I run XChat because I always liked XChat more than other IRC clients, and I keep a VM around just to go and run XChat. So there you go. Okay. So you can see how you run them side by side. You use Synaptic to go and manage packages, which you just saw me go and do. And, of course, you can go and remove packages as necessary. You can go and install other Linux distros, such as SUSE. In theory, as I said, the way that you would have done it before this is you would have gone and spun up a VM in Hyper-V, and you would have gone and put that on another desktop and switch between them. If you still want to go and run BSD, yeah, you can go and do that, but that's starting to become much more of an edge case. But the advantage here is that people can basically have all of those tools just like they have if they're running OS X, because if you've had OS X, you can have your X Windows server there and you can go and run all of these tools. Of course, then it needs to be built for OS X. So the advantage sort of with Windows here is that you're just basically pulling off Ubuntu. So as long as it's in Ubuntu, you can go and run it on Windows. And that is a huge change in philosophy from Microsoft, because it's literally Microsoft saying, okay, we're going to allow you to go and not only put your app store in there, so to speak, anything that you run there, you can now run there. And we're going to make it so it's a first-class citizen on Windows. Okay, so you've seen the demo. What works and what doesn't? There's a beta of a brand new technology. There are gaps. Things will work well, TM. Bash and core Unix tools, they all work. Apt-get, your way to happiness. Git, clone all your repos. Ruby, Node, GNU, CC, Go, Rust. If you follow the blog, there's even Visual Studio tools now where you can build tools for Linux in Visual Studio. You can also then go and configure with Visual Studio Code to use Bash as your default edit console, rather than just using PowerShell or using CMD. Microsoft is working hard to close gaps. If you find a bug, log the bug. They're then going to try and deal with it. With Creator Update, significant improvements, supporting major dev tools that run on Linux, languages and platforms, big improvements in the console, broader and deeper syscalls, more tools, languages, platform, Node.js, Go, Ruby, Java, file change notification support, improved network support. So at the moment, sometimes if you're running on anniversary update and you try a ping, you'll get a network error, but they've figured that out so that if you go and do it now on the Creator update, all of your networking tools pretty much work. So that was just a matter of, again, getting that translation between how Windows does things and how Linux does things and figuring out how to get those to work together. Ubuntu 16.04 support, which you saw me doing that VM. Interoperability, you can eventually call Windows executables directly from Bash, Tmux and Windows PowerShell, for example. So if I actually go back here and pull up that VM, I can actually go PowerShell. Oopsie-daisy, that hasn't found it, so if I go... Oh, okay. So I'm calling PowerShell from... Okay. Call Bash from Windows. So you'll be able to call Bash from Windows and then do Bash stuff. So Bash minus C ls -af. That you'll be able to do that from the command prompt as well. Improvements, full glorious 24-bit color. We saw that improved rendering in Vim, Emacs, Tmux, and Midnight Commander and so forth, and full mouse support. So the idea is that you'll be able to use mouse with your console as well. So to a certain extent, your Windows machine is going to become a really kick-ass Linux machine. There's an array of community tools. User voice is akko.ms/winbashuv. GitHub issues are winbashgithub. The blog, there's a command line blog, and then there's a specific Windows subsystem for Linux blog. Follow richturner_ms for lots of updates. He's basically the program manager who is in charge of this. So if you want to talk to someone who is basically in charge of this feature, this is the guy to talk to, and he is really responsive to comments and to constructive criticism. You can learn more at these particular addresses, so learn Windows Subsystem for Linux, WSL Docs, and CLI blog. Again, this is it seems to be quite a priority for Microsoft. It was interesting, I got interviewed by Channel 9 yesterday. Now, I've been writing books for Microsoft for 15 years, never been interviewed by Channel 9. I put this session up in the catalogue, and even though there's only a small number of you compared to my usual sessions, this was something that Microsoft glommed onto, and they wanted to promote this session because they want to show that they're really doing things.
I started looking at this a while ago.
Yeah.
And wanted to do that desktop. Finding information on how to do that drove me insane to the point where I went, yeah, I'm over it, and stopped using it.
Okay, so one of the...
You can't find the info on how to do it.
Yeah. So there is a challenge that they've got in terms of what an official Microsoft person can speak about and what someone who's not official like me can speak about. I can go and do this presentation because I'm not Microsoft, and I can say, okay, when they go and do it, they've got a whole supportability thing going on. So if they go and officially document certain things, but eventually all of this will be officially documented. This, of course, goes up on Channel 9, and then suddenly one of the reasons that they want to put on a session like this is that this exposes all of that, how you go and do it, to a broader audience. So yes, it's not documented, but eventually it will be. But at the moment, they're sort of saying, okay, X Windows support we know is flakier than console support.
I can live with flaky. I couldn't find any way of intelligently doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, Absolutely. It took me, the reason I put together the talk was that there was all of these things that I found hard to do, and I just collected all of the wisdom. I thought, I'll go and put it in a talk. And that's why it works well for Microsoft, because then they go, well, you can go and look at that. This is something that's not one of us, but this is someone who's enthusiastic about it. And of course, that's pretty much the way the open source movement works, isn't it? Documentation happens through enthusiasm rather than necessarily paid support. And you're seeing more of that approach with Microsoft's documentation across other products as well, is that what they would say to me is go and figure it out and then go and submit a pull request with your updated documentation on how to do this, and then they'll decide whether or not to publish it, which is, again, very different from the old sort of cathedral approach where basically, you know, you would ask them to do it and then maybe a priest would come down and actually go and write it for you. So it's certainly possible, if you went and submitted a pull request and said, okay, I've got how you can get CompEs working, and this is how you do it, that documentation might end up on Microsoft's site. I can't guarantee that it will, but that's basically the approach now. Yep?
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of this. I can see what's in it for Microsoft in the short term. I'm not convinced I can see what's in it for Microsoft in the long term.
Okay, so let me give you some interesting stats. 90-95% of workloads running in AWS, which is the leading cloud provider by market share and by revenue, are running what operating system? 33% of workloads running in Azure are running Linux. Now, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that if Azure is going to end up competing with AWS, that the rate of Linux deployments in Azure is going that way, not that way. So if people are primarily deploying Linux workloads in Azure, and let's face it, Microsoft's always talking about cloud, 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 what do they need really good support for? They need a really good Linux story. So this is all my personal opinion. This is not Microsoft policy or anything. This is what I'm looking at the company and I'm going, why are they doing this? And this is where this is how it makes sense in my head. Is that they're very aware. So again, I read a lot of books about sort of Silicon Valley companies, and there's two. There's Disrupted by Dan Lyons, and then there's Code Monkeys, and I forget the guy's name. And he's a very abrasive writer, but he talks about his own experiences in sort of developing applications in Silicon Valley and developing workloads. And it's all that he's literally pulling up a shell on his Mac. He's pulling these open source tools out, and then he's using these open source tools to deploy to that. Now, we've got a very different ecosystem between your weekend hackers and then your corporate, white-collar hackers. I mean, coders. And by hackers, I'm not meaning attackers. I'm just meaning like coders, right? And this is the thing, is that Microsoft may feel, my opinion, that they missed a generation of Silicon Valley hackers. That picture from TechCrunch, from the stage of TechCrunch disruptive, everybody running MacBooks, is damning for Microsoft, because suddenly you have almost an entire generation of digerati who are refusing to interact with Microsoft products. Now, are they refusing because they're living back in the 90s when there was a great war between Microsoft and open source? No, they don't, because when they looked into it, it was like, no, we don't care about that. I mean, literally, if you explain to someone who wasn't around in the 90s that there was an issue here, they're looking at you like you've got another head, okay? It matters to nerds in middle age. It doesn't matter to someone who's 25. So it's really about availability of tools. And if you are thinking of hacking on something and you're wanting to do it as cheaply as possible, do you stand up a Windows server? Or do you go and get a trial AWS account or a trial Microsoft account, and then you try and get the most out of it? What's cheaper to run? A small Linux instance. What's Raspberry Pi running? Linux. All of these things are running this thing. Now, it's not that Microsoft's giving up on Windows Server, but it knows that the value proposition for Windows Server is very different from someone who's an 18-year-old or a 21-year-old who's hacking away in their dorm at college compared to someone who's 35 or 40 who's working in a big corporate. Because your tool, what you want out of your tools is different. Think about it as the difference between having a factory, which is your corporate environment, or you've got your own sort of shed where you've got a bunch of tools and you're doing some woodwork or you're creating your own stuff in the basement. So by embracing this, there is, to a degree, we're going to provide you with all of the tools that if you want to go and do this in your own workshop, you can go and do it with the tools that you're happy with. And it's not about withholding tools from you because you're on the wrong platform. No, we'll give you all of the tools that you want. And it's interesting to see this dichotomy with Apple, where Apple's basically saying, no, we want to have this very walled garden approach where we control your experience, that we're going to limit what you can do, but we're going to give really beautiful hardware that's really functional, but is very much for a premium consumer, because there's certainly a lot of money in that. But that doesn't necessarily suit the 18-year-old coder sitting in her college dorm who's wanting to put together something different. And there's also an idea, and we've seen this with the movie Arrival, that languages influence how we think. And programming languages might influence how we think about problems. And it could be that the next revolutionary product comes from someone who's using a language that gets them to think in a way that's quite different from the C# way of thinking, or the Java way of thinking, or the C++ way of thinking. And if that person has access to those tools because they're open source and they're running on Windows, that is not a negative benefit. It's not a disincentive for Microsoft. Again, if you're running on Windows and you're getting this great experience of Linux on Windows, how you think about Microsoft's other attempts to integrate Linux, it's naturally you're thinking, you know, Linux on Azure actually might work pretty well. Why? Well, Linux on Windows runs pretty well. Suddenly I don't have to sit there and say, well, you know, I have to run it on AWS or I have to run it on Google Cloud, because clearly those guys understand the Linux ecosystem. If you're running Ubuntu on Windows and it's a great experience, you're going, Microsoft seems to understand. Maybe I'll go and run it in Azure. Other questions? So the way it works is that it's all in, if you're on FastSpring, you will get updates as they come. So the way that Windows 10 works, if you've got current branch. So current branch is also usually made an LTSB branch as well. So if you're basically staying on an LTSB branch, yeah, but you're not going to get updated. You will be... That's a good question, which I don't know the answer to. I'm assuming that they're going to stick with that. However, there is instructions on the internet where you can go and rip off whatever's there and then go and put in SUSE. There's people that have put Red Hat in. There's people, so I'm assuming if you wanted to go to one of the other distributions, you could do that. You could go and figure out how to do that. And eventually there's going to be tools around to do that. But it's about giving people options, right? And then not locking it down and saying, right, you're only running Ubuntu. They're like, oh, cool. Someone's worked out how to get Slackware running on this. We wouldn't do that, but if you want to do that, excellent. So it's possible. There's a Jessica Dean. If you search for Jessica Dean's blog, she actually shows how you can set up an SSH server in Windows Subsystem for Linux, and then she SSHs across from her Mac to her Windows box and starts doing stuff in her Windows box. Oh, okay. I'm assuming if you put it in, it'll still come up as slash. So I can't answer that fully. My guess is that it'll be abstracted by the made available through the Windows subsystem. But then there may be in terms of direct access. So of course the question is, how would you run something like Snort or something like that? But I am imagining that that's enough of a use case that they're going to figure some way to give you that sort of hardware level access to the Ethernet. So I think that, so Microsoft doesn't do an X server. And the X server that does this looks like it's got about 3,000 or 4,000 downloads on SourceForge. Whether or not that's an accurate figure, I've got no idea. So at the moment, I imagine if it took off, that they'd have to do a Microsoft X server that would go and support everything. Because it just doesn't make sense to go and keep pointing people to some obscure small project that some poor bugger's doing on SourceForge and having him sort of bear the weight of whatever's going on. But I can't speak to that. I mean, my guess is, you know, it's like what happened, it used to be, and it's been a while since I ran, when I first had one of my Macs, 15 years ago. I mean, I've still got a MacBook Pro. I just don't run all of those tools on it because I just went, screw it, I'll just run a VM. But it used to be that you had to run a separate X server that you had to get from somewhere else. Now, I understood at some point Apple allowed you to just basically pump straight through to the server that they were using or not. Yeah, but I believe that at a certain point you didn't need to go down and get a third-party X server.
The utilities just came with OSX.
Yeah.
And that's where you got your...
Yeah, but there was a special thing that you could add on, and then you could get all of the Linux user land utilities as well, and then you could get all the X utilities. So
in regards to that, they're also working on getting rid of the X.
On OSX? Oh, okay, yeah. And so eventually there'll be changes. Although, you know, they've been talking about getting rid of X since the 80s, so, you know.
I did this topic before in, for like a Linux crowd.
Yeah.
And I had the same question, like, why in different talks. And the question is, is Microsoft moving this to Windows 7?
No. No. Okay, so this is never going to be backported. So basically Windows 7 is functionally, I'm not going to say on life support, none of this is going to go back. It's like we had with, you know, I thought that the smartest thing that Microsoft could have done to get people into the Windows Store would be to backport it to Windows 7. I mean, when Windows 8 came out and you had all of that environment with the touch and all of the universal Windows platform or the Metro platform, if Microsoft had just said, here's a download, you can go and put it on Windows 7, that would have gone bananas, right? And they didn't do it. And I was like, well, that was silly. So...
As an admin of a fairly locked down Windows environment, should I have any concerns?
You can lock it so it can't be turned on, because by default you wouldn't allow someone to do that. So in that scenario, you're probably not wanting them to go and install developer tools. You're wanting to keep it so that you've got authorized apps.
Some use cases, even for a subset, what am I exposing myself to?
If you're turning it on, you're basically giving someone within that environment the ability, because when they set it up, right, they set a root password, and if they've got the root password to their environment, they can run a full Linux. What would, I mean, it's not a virtual machine, but it functionally would, you'd be able to do anything that you could do, because they're not locked down in terms of when you're locking down a Windows desktop, you're saying you can run this app and not that app. You're basically here saying, well, you can run WSL, so anything you can do within WSL, so yeah, assume it's that they've basically got their own Linux VM that they're root access to. I think that in the long run, the way that they're probably going to get around it, it certainly won't be group policy. It'll be something like desired state configuration, because obviously desired state configuration is being developed for Linux. So basically you would push something like DSC or Chef or Puppet, and you would control the configuration that way in terms of what the configuration of those machines look like. So what you could do if you wanted to stop it running? That's the issue. So there's Credential Guard and Device Guard. Now, Device Guard's sort of like App Blocker on steroids. Again, my guess is at this stage, no, it wouldn't. I mean, they'd have to do a whole lot of work to get it to do that. So you'd almost be wanting to look at a technology that was sort of Linux native on... Okay, so let me actually show you that on the thing. So that's a good question. So let's go across here and let's get rid of that VM. So if I run here and I go Task Manager, so what you can see here is I've got Bash Instance, Bash Instance, Bash Instance, Bash Instance. So those are all of my, each of my windows that are running there. So I've got Dbus Daemons. What else have I got? GNOME Putty Helper, GNOME Terminal. So basically you can see... Pardon? Yeah. Yeah. But at the moment, this is definitely... Think of this as sort of the horses are definitely bolting, and I'll figure out how to capture them later. But
it's more doing a blacklist rather than white.
Yeah.
I really don't want you to run this.
Yeah. But, yeah. I mean, there's always going to be this tension, and especially with developers, there's always a tension between IT pros and developers, because developers want a lot of freedom in their environment. I went and did this interview for Channel 9 yesterday, where I was basically talking about the difference between IT pros and developers, and a few developers made very snarky comments on Twitter, like, where did the developer touch you, you know, because... Because one of the things I pointed out, the average age of an IT pro is mid-40s. The average age of a developer is mid-20s. And the thing is, the average age of an IT pro actually goes up a year every year, because there's not a lot of people coming in at the new end, because we're basically automating away the need for new people to come into the profession. But the weird, really weird thing is going to be, in a couple of years, average age of an IT pro is going to be the average age of a parent of a developer. So suddenly we go from a relationship that's already fraught to, you're not the boss of me, you're not my dad, you're not my real dad. It's going to be interesting. Yeah, so there's an architectural discussion of that sort of thing, and obviously there are security implications. But yeah, you see, I certainly didn't have to elevate to do that. Well, so I'm trying to think of an experiment that I can do without absolutely destroying my machine. But feel free to explore with your own virtual machine. Okay, let's have a look. So let's go back to that VM, because if I destroy that, that's not going to be a problem. Get back. And go back to bash. Okay, so cd mnt c windows system. What is it? It's system 32. Changing a read-only file, so it's read-only. So I'm not even going to start playing around with Chmod. play around with that, so I'm assuming, because it's obviously it hasn't elevated, so, but you can run it, bash is elevated, so that would be interesting, wouldn't it? Yeah, so anyway, please fill out your evaluations. Because I've actually got to deliver another session in about 2 minutes. Fill out your session evaluation. Continue your learning path. If you've got any questions for me, you can get me on @OrinThomas or Orin.Thomas@hotmail.com. Happy to answer them. Thank you very much for your attention.